A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sim. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display? I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
You are just number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 220. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and this time we are talking about Dracula from the Mystery and Imagination series. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello. So Dracula, this is a 1968 black and white version from ITV. And as you said, Brian, it was from their spooky series Mystery and Imagination. This particular episode ran 90 minutes and it was the third and in fact final episode of the fourth series of Mystery and Imagination, a series that we have touched upon before, Brian.
Yes, that's right. And this is more horror than science fiction, clearly, but it's something we wanted to do because it's an interesting production in a related drama, and of course it's the right season. We're releasing this in October for Halloween as well.
It's our spooky special.
Indeed. It was broadcast the week after their version of Frankenstein on Mystery and Imagination, which we covered just about a year ago in British Invaders 194 and 195. That was also a very interesting production in this series. And these types of productions give us the chance to discuss these sort of classic archetypal stories in productions that are quite faithful to the original versions and carry, in this case, the sort of Victorian setting for the classic vampires.
Yes, it's good fun. And I am pleased that we are completing our lineup of Victorian archetypes by finally getting to Dracula himself. So, yeah, splendid stuff.
Yes, for sure.
So the setup, we begin with the elegant and oh-so-charming Count Dracula as a guest of Dr. Seward. In fact, we first meet him at some sort of evening party where Dracula is entertaining the guests by playing the piano rather beautifully. But meanwhile, the doctor, Dr. Seward, is somewhat distracted, and in particular by a mysterious inmate at the asylum that he seems to supervise. So a strange patient who's puzzling him.
That's right. And we also have the Count's attention being drawn to the young and beautiful Lucy Weston. And her friend Mina Harker, of course, shows up. And Mina Harker believes that Dracula has something to do with the disappearance of her husband, Jonathan Harker.
Yes, and we'll hear more about him later on and some things they've done with the characters to make this work for television.
Yes, if you're familiar with the story of Dracula, especially in the sort of form that it was in the original novel, these should be familiar elements that are being put in place here.
So, our characters, obviously we have got the nefarious Count Dracula himself, played in a rather suave, intelligent and articulate fashion by the great British actor Denham Elliot. Dracula, who claims he has a skin condition which prevents his going out in sunlight, and also the rather stylish pair of dark glasses that he's wearing in the first scenes. He is, as I've said, he's a very sort of smooth, charming man of society, Count Dracula, that we're seeing here.
Yes, it's a more human portrayal, clearly the vampire character, but not the sort of more physically monstrous one that we see in some types of productions. And he uses this sort of Eastern European accent, but it's less the stereotypical Dracula voice or Dracula accent, and more just something with an Eastern European kind of flavor to it. Dr. Seward, played by James Maxwell, is a professional and concerned doctor. He's engaged to young Lucy Weston and is very concerned with the issues that come up and very much looking to approach things in a scientific way.
Yes, and while his scientific interests are diverted by his patient, his young fiancée Lucy will be charmed by the enigmatic and delightful Count. And Lucy was played by a very young Susan George, a fairly well-known British film and television actress. And we'll be talking about one of her other roles a bit later on when we talk about this in more depth. But she's the intended victim. She's the target that Dracula has in his sights.
That's right. And Mina Harker, played by Suzanne Neve, is Lucy's friend, and she is searching for the truth about what happened to her husband, and also being protective towards Lucy, and at some times suspicious towards Count Dracula and so on.
That's right, yes. She's a suspicious and distrustful character and not taken in quite so easily as Lucy is.
Yes, now Jonathan Harker, of course, is part of this as well, played by Corin Redgrave, who would, about 30 years later, appear in Channel 4's vampire-type series, Ultraviolet. So interesting to see him showing up in multiple vampire shows that way. He had not been seen since A Journey to Transylvania and a visit to Count Dracula, and it's not clear what's happened when he reappears.
Yes, that's right. Although the mystery of Harker's disappearance will be solved fairly shortly. We'll get to that. We'll mention a couple of other characters. Of course, we have to have a vampire hunter, and we have to have Professor Van Helsing himself here, played by Bernard Archard. An expert brought in to examine the strange case of this poor madman in the asylum. But of course, he is the first one to realise that there is an attack of vampirism going on. And he makes his attempts to protect the various people from the vampire while he tries to figure out who it is. Another slightly Eastern European accent, I think, from Bernard Archard for the learned professor.
Yes, and he's played as the sort of more elderly, scholarly type of Van Helsing, rather than the more active action hero type that we get in some other portrayals.
Yes, that's right. Perhaps compared to Peter Cushing in the Hammer movies, this is an older version that's perhaps closer to the one we saw from the actor whose last name is Sloane, I believe, Herbert Sloane, in the original Bela Lugosi film.
Yes, that's right. It's more along those lines.
One quick mention for British television, not particularly for genre stuff, but Miss Marple is there. Joan Hickson, the actress who had a very famous run as Miss Marple on television, I think in the 80s, played Mrs. Weston, so that's Lucy's mother, who obviously is extremely concerned as her daughter appears to be falling ill for no obvious reasons, although the rest of us who know what's going on can soon figure it out.
Yes, I knew I recognized her. Of course, you're right. It was Miss Marple from that famous run. Now, getting into a little bit of the story, it tends to concentrate on the middle section of the book where the Count has already arrived in English society and is interacting with these English characters, with only brief flashbacks to Jonathan Harker's misadventures in the Count's castle. It really doesn't focus on the Transylvanian part of things. It focuses on the English sequence of events.
Yes, that's right. Jonathan Harker's trip to the Count's castle, basically we just see this brief flashback to when he is being threatened by Dracula's vampire women in what's quite a sort of sexy scene, I think, for a 1968 production, but it's only very briefly shown. And then we get a clever little elision, I suppose, in the plot, because what they do is they have Jonathan Harker substitute for the character of Renfield from the novel. So you won't be too surprised to learn that the mysterious madman in the asylum is indeed Jonathan Harker. And that explains some of the stuff that's been going on and why he's not been heard of since his return from Transylvania, because he appears to have gone mad.
That's right. And this is one of these situations where they were adapting the novel Dracula to a 90-minute drama and a studio-bound one with minimal locations. But probably the duration was the bigger limitation. So those types of little changes and setting the focus that way allowed them to do something that in many ways was really quite faithful, but focused where it needed to.
Yes, and it does keep the action limited to a few locations. So we have Dr. Seward's house, we have the hospital or asylum, and we have a nearby graveyard, of course, which will crop up several times. And so not too many locations, helpful for a TV production. They didn't have to try and sort of range out further into the world and show more of Transylvania or of the crossing and the famous landing at Whitby and things like that. So, they've scaled things down for television production, and it works quite well by concentrating on that middle section of the book when Dracula is at large in England.
Yes, that's right.
Count, it seems impossible to believe.
The deranged mind has long been a subject of interest to me, Dr. Seward. I found your own recent treatise on the subject quite fascinating, though, may I say, simply as an amateur, I beg to differ with you on certain questions.
Indeed. Oh, Mrs. H., there's some broken glass. Now, there's no panic, but I wonder if you could clean it up. Mrs. Weston, pray accept my profoundest apologies.
Oh, that poor man.
So getting into our production notes, Bram Stoker's novel Dracula was published in 1897 and ultimately became the source for many stage, film, and television adaptations. It seems the character of Dracula has appeared in over 200 films, and it seems like Dracula may actually have the record for the largest number of film appearances of any one character. So it's a character who has really been used in all sorts of things and sort of evolved into something that is sometimes a little bit different from what the original novel had.
Yes, fascinating that there have been so many films featuring this character. We were talking about it before recording as to whether, you know, characters like Tarzan and others would actually count as being anywhere near that number. But yes, well over 200 films featuring Dracula. And of course, most famously, we've mentioned already, 1931, Bela Lugosi in the Universal version, the one that probably everybody has seen, the one that gave us that image of the classic caped count with his particular hairstyle and his sort of society clothes. But of course, we've had other well-known interpretations here in Britain. Of course, we're very fond of Christopher Lee in the 1958 Hammer Studios film. And in six, I believe, subsequent sequels, rather a more perhaps monstrous Dracula, you know, in places. Clearly a very articulate and elegant character at some times, quite a sexual vampire, but also at times really much more monstrous and horrific than the Bela Lugosi version.
Yes, by the time Hammer Horror Studios had Dracula, Prince of Darkness, he basically had no dialogue. He spent most of the film hissing, which is an interesting choice when you have an actor like Christopher Lee who could deliver dialogue so wonderfully. But still, they had a lot of interesting things in that whole saga of the Hammer Dracula. So there are interesting things there as well.
Yes, that's right. Interesting stuff. And for more about Christopher Lee and the Hammer Studios films, do check out Mr. Jim Moon and the excellent Hip the Bobs podcast, which has recently run a series about the late lamented actor's illustrious career. So, turning our attention to Mystery and Imagination, this television series from ITV, which we know ran for five series from 1966 right up to 1970.
That's right. And they adapted quite a number of gothic horror classics and ghost stories from authors like M.R. James and Algernon Blackwood. They really tended towards adapting these classic stories. And it was the fourth series that was produced by Jonathan Alwyn and Reginald Collins that gave us three different 90-minute productions. First Uncle Silas, then Frankenstein, and then Dracula.
Yes, that's right. And it's I think it's a different production team to the ones we discussed who started the series when we talked about Frankenstein. But by, as you say, by the fourth series, it's Alwyn and Collins who are in charge. And here we have Bram Stoker's famous novel being adapted for the screen by Charles Graham, directed by Patrick Dromgoole, who also would go on to be involved directing She-Wolf of London, not one of our favourites, but perhaps also much better standard Robin of Sherwood, which we liked an awful lot better.
Yes, he went on to produce a lot of series as time went on and was quite important in rolling out a number of new series for ITV later on in the 80s and so on.
As well as that, we've got some nicely gothic and spooky music composed especially for this episode by Paul Lewis, which works quite well. And we know that the whole thing was filmed at ITV's Teddington Studios in early November of 1968.
There were a few special effects in this. The vampire's teeth were done with sort of makeup effects that tend to resemble the rat-like incisors of the novel rather than the sort of canine fangs we tend to see with Christopher Lee and most other versions. This was much more sort of right in the front of the mouth, the extended teeth there that seemed to match quite well with the marks that they would show where someone had been bitten by a vampire. And they had a quite impressive shot of the disintegrating body of Dracula that was produced by pouring acid over a wax face that was built onto apparently a real skull of some sort. So, interesting stuff. They did a lot of fairly simple effects with sort of fade in of the character of Dracula when he appears and fade out, this sort of thing. But they were used quite effectively, and that sort of ultimate disintegrating shot is really quite effective.
Yes, it is. It's a splendid shot. I mean, you know, we do love to see Dracula defeated. I mean, I don't think we're giving away too much in the way of spoilers to say that they do obviously defeat Dracula, and his disintegration is a memorable television moment that recalls the epic climax to the first Hammer Dracula with Cushing and Lee.
Yes, absolutely. Dracula was broadcast as part of Mystery and Imagination on November 18th of 1968, which was quite a quick turnaround from when it had just been filmed, quite, you know, not much earlier.
Yes, I was quite astonished by that from the production notes booklet that it was, they turned this round in a few weeks. This was, you know, fast moving television production and get it ready, get it out there. Quite interesting.
Yes, it comes from a time when television was being produced in a way that was much like theater, where instead of recording sort of brief clips and editing them together as you have in a more film-influenced way and things that are done more now, it was done where you would have sort of the long scenes that would be performed at once, or long sequences of scenes even, that would be performed at once and recorded. So there was much less that would happen in editing and post-production.
Okay. We again know from the production notes booklet in the DVD set that it was well received by the critics, but I don't know of any repeat airings at all. I would have thought that probably it would have had repeats over the years, but I've got no details of those. So it may be that it hasn't been seen until we get to the DVD set that we've been looking at.
Yes, that's right. I haven't heard anything about broadcast repeats of this one.
So, availability, and very neatly, Region 2, we have, yet again, a network DVD release. We discussed it before when we talked about Frankenstein. This came out in 2010. 4 discs in the box, all 6 episodes from the 4th and 5th series, including Frankenstein and Dracula, obviously. 2 surviving episodes from Series 1, that's Fall of the House of Usher and The Open Door by Mrs. Oliphant, and a few surviving clips of a missing Cast in the Ruins adaptation, an M.R. James story, one of those adaptations that, because it's lost, has sort of gained a certain scary notoriety, as the way that lost television sometimes does. Plus, we've got this extensive notes booklet with episodes guides by, yet again, the famous TV historian Andrew Pixley. And all in all, that package, currently around £18 on Amazon here in the UK. And quite a nice package this time from Network DVD. So well done them.
Yes, it's a lovely DVD set that gives you this collection of really interesting sort of classic horror and ghost story adaptations from the 60s that tend to be quite well done. So it's a really neat little package of some fairly obscure productions from ITV.
But sadly, over in Region 1...
there is no release in Region 1 of this, and I am not aware of foreign broadcasts or foreign distribution of any of the Mystery and Imagination episodes. It may be that there was some, but I don't think there was anything that was very high profile, so there have not been any releases of it. You can find the Region 2 import on Amazon.com, but it runs for about $75 there, so doing a direct import from amazon.co.uk would be less expensive.
Okay. One of these situations where we're a bit more fortunate in Region 2 to have quite a nice set and quite easy to get hold of it.
Yes, for sure.
If you want some gothic horror, well, you could look worse places.
Oh, it's a lovely set to be able to sort of slowly run through these different productions that have sort of a faithful take, but a nice production of various classic stories.
Okay, so come back and join us next time for the second part of our discussion. We're going to talk a little bit about Denham Elliot himself as the Count and the success of this adaptation compared with some other TV versions. Plus, of course, we'll get to our reviews and give you a recommendation whether to buy the box set if you haven't already done so after Frankenstein.
Absolutely. Lots of good things to talk about next time. So in the meantime, you can find us at BritishInvaders.com, or if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you will find our Facebook group with lots of fun discussions going on, which we'd love to have you join in with.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, do come and join us and have some fun at the Voice of Geeks internet radio channel. That's vognetwork.com, where you will find British Invaders going out on Mondays and Tuesdays, but a whole host of other geek-related shows for your entertainment. There's a community there. We're proud members of the Vogue Network, and do come along and check out the fun.
Yes, absolutely. So thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada signing off.
Yes, thank you very much, and do join us back next time. Until then, Eamon in England also signing off.